live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a hidden camera found outside the Ulster County Area Transit Building is at the center of a growing dispute between the county executive and controller March Gallagher. The camera was Gallagher's, and she says it's part of an investigation into alleged falsification of time records. County officials say employees were recorded without their knowledge. We'll have the latest on this investigation coming up. Extreme heat is putting new pressure on New York's electric grid and raising questions about energy costs and reliability. We'll talk with the Building Decarbonization Coalition about how clean energy and building efficiency and technologies could help. Plus, the history of the anti-rent movement in New York and the film that's telling that story, and vocalist and producer David Driver. That's all coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Stocks on Wall Street opened higher this morning as investors tune in to hear a speech at this hour from Federal Reserve Chairman Kevin Warsh. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 145 points in early trading.
Investors are eager to hear from the new central bank leader about how he and his colleagues plan to tackle stubborn inflation. Warsh has repeatedly vowed to restore price stability, but markets have been disappointed by the lack of detail so far. The Fed chairman's last news conference, following a rate-setting meeting in July, was greeted by a stock market sell-off. Warsh has been deliberately vague about his outlook, arguing that too much talking can tie the Fed's hands and distort the signals that financial markets are sending about the economy. Annual inflation in July was 3.7%, according to the Fed's preferred yardstick, well above the central bank's target of 2%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is offering assurances that Russian President Vladimir Putin will not wage a military operation on a NATO country. NPR's Greg Myrie reports Trump spoke following a visit to Moscow by the director of the CIA.
President Trump was asked if President Putin might be considering additional military action in Europe.
I've had good talks with him. He's not going to be attacking a NATO territory.
CIA Director John Ratcliffe made an unannounced trip to Moscow on Tuesday, igniting speculation about the reason for his visit. The CIA has declined to comment. However, a U.S. official said Ratcliffe warned Russia against attacking NATO countries. The CIA chief also told the Russians the U.S. has conclusive evidence Russia is providing intelligence to Iran. The U.S. official was not authorized to discuss the matter publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
The Canadian Prime Minister is reacting to President Trump's executive order renaming Lake Ontario to Lake America. Dan Karpinchuk reports Trump announced the name change on Thursday amid the escalating trade war between the two nations.
Prime Minister Mark Carney says no matter what the U.S. calls it, Canadians will know it as Lake Ontario, then, now, and always. It's the latest tit-for-tat in what's becoming a bitter trade war, fanned by insults from Trump and mainly from Ontario Premier Doug Ford. Carney also provided some history, posting on social media that the name Lake Ontario comes from the indigenous Wendat Nation word Ontario, which translated means the lake is beautiful, the lake is big. The consensus among Canadians is that Trump can do what he wants as far as the U.S. is able to, but cannot dictate what Canadians call Lake Ontario, or even what the international community or other countries call it. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
This is NPR News in Washington. Two executives and a reporter for Stars and Stripes have filed a lawsuit against the Pentagon for firing them. They allege that top Defense Department officials retaliated for recent reporting and for standing up for the paper's journalistic independence. NPR's David Folkenflik has more.
Stars and Stripes covers military matters. It's funded in part by the Congress through the Pentagon's budget. Early this year, the Pentagon's chief spokesman posted on social media that he wanted to refocus Stars and Stripes, quote, away from the woke distractions that siphon morale. In July, editor-in-chief Eric Slavin and reporter Lara Corti spoke to CBS News about concerns their independence was being eroded. Then the paper reported on deteriorating conditions on the USS Abraham Lincoln in the Persian Gulf. The two were fired. Publisher Max Lederer was fired, too, after he announced he'd retire rather than terminate them. The three journalists are asking a federal judge to intervene to block the firings from taking effect. The Pentagon declined comment, citing the litigation. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
A federal judge is again blocking President Trump's executive order aimed at restricting mail-in voting ahead of the midterm elections. The judge imposed a 14-day hold following another round of lawsuits just days before ballots are set to go out. The Supreme Court sided with Trump earlier this week, finding the lower court had acted prematurely, but the justices did not rule on whether the president's order is legal. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 74 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, the National Weather Service says it's going to be a pleasant weekend weather-wise, but we've experienced some extraordinary heat this summer, and those extreme temperatures are putting added pressure on the electric grid as people rely more heavily on air conditioning. At the same time, many households are facing higher energy bills. A coalition of New York environmental advocates say that improving the efficiency of buildings and expanding clean energy could help address both climate and energy challenges while potentially making the grid more resilient. Joining us now is Michael Hernandez of the Building Decarbonization Coalition with more. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tim. Glad to be here.
As I said, we've just experienced an extraordinary stretch of extreme heat in New York. I think July was the hottest on record in New York City and some other parts of the state. From your perspective, what's that heat telling us about the pressure our electric grid is going to face in the years ahead?
Well, we're very concerned. New York has been very concerned about the pressure on the grid. In 2022, we passed a law requiring utilities to do a climate vulnerability study. So each utility, Con Edison, Central Hudson, NYSEG, they've all done these climate vulnerability studies, and they show we're projected to have an exponential increase in those extreme heat days. And that can drive up energy costs and strain the grid.
Folks here in the Catskills and Hudson Valley may think that a lot of that grid strain is in New York City and on Long Island, but it really is throughout the state. What does that extreme heat mean for communities like ours where the population's more spread out? Infrastructure can be very different.
Well, more and more we do see in the region of the Catskills that there are some constraints on the grid. And whenever you have increased demand on the electric grid, that will require additional generators of energy to come online. Generally, those additional generators of energy, what we call peaker plants, run on fossil fuels, and it drives up the energy costs. And so what the state has been moving towards is getting more renewables online. Renewables are very, affordable energy sources, and that can be renewables that are on our grid, but that can also be renewables and energy efficiency upgrades for your home.
High electricity bill is another major concern, not just during heat waves. We hear a lot about how electric companies are asking for more rate hikes. People are strained a bit when it comes to making their monthly energy bills. Why do electricity bills seem to become so expensive precisely when folks need, things like air conditioning the most?
Yeah, it's really due to the supply of electricity. Generally, New York State goes for the cheapestly, the most expensive generated, the most affordable generation of electricity as our baseline. But as the demand goes up and we have to turn on more expensive peaker plants, that really drives up the cost. So what people can do is there's programs in New York State like the Empower Plus program that will provide incentives to New Yorkers. Low and moderate income New Yorkers can get up to $14,000 to do energy upgrades in their home, to do air sealing, heat pump installation, insulation in their homes. And so all of that and a free energy audit. A lot of people, in order to sort of get rid of that decades old, appliance that or a heating system that is inefficient, generally fossil fuel, and replace them with clean heat pumps that provide both heating in the winter and cooling in the summer and are very energy efficient. We're encouraging people to utilize the Empower Plus program and some of the other programs that are available to make that transition and bring down their energy costs.
Heat pumps, other practical options like insulation, rooftop solar, even battery storage, those can help reduce energy consumption and bills too, right?
Absolutely. The New York State did a climate scoping plan, and they had strategic strategies on how do we actually keep our energy bills down. That was exactly right. Resiliency within the premise. If you can generate your own electricity through solar, and you can store it in a battery, and then that means you have less dependence on the energy grid and the cost of energy that you get from that grid. And so that's really encouraging. And then having those energy efficient appliances like heat pumps just magnifies the ability to utilize that clean energy and not spend a lot of money doing it.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Michael Hernandez of the Building Decarbonization Coalition about how improving the efficiency of buildings and homes and expanding clean energy can help address both climate and energy challenges. Michael, New York has some ambitious climate and clean energy goals, even though some of them may have been weakened in the last budget. There are also concerns about affordability. How can we make sure that the transition to cleaner buildings and energy doesn't leave folks behind, especially those rural and lower income residents?
Absolutely. New York has identified disadvantaged communities. These are communities that generally feel the real brunt of climate change and high energy bill burden. And so we're really focusing on how can we provide those homes with incentives and make sure they're not left behind in that transition. And so that's why we have the Empower Plus program. Over the last 2 years, the state has authorized $2 billion for the Sustainable Future Fund, a portion of which goes into the Empower Plus program, which provides incentives to New Yorkers, especially low and moderate income New Yorkers, so that they can make that transition. And if you go to your regional clean energy hub or NYSERDA's website, My Energy Portal, you will be able to find out how you may qualify to get these really great incentives for appliances to make that transition. And they're specifically targeted for low and moderate income households.
And we're talking about households and some of those examples like solar and heat pumps, reducing demand on the grid, especially during extreme heat. Here in Sullivan County, there's a solar array proposed in the town of Thompson. It's a very large proposal. Folks are pushing back against that in some corners of the county. Could distributed energy resources like solar on public buildings or farms or businesses play a bigger role, though, in places like Sullivan, Ulster, Delaware, Orange County, these rural upstate counties?
Absolutely. The closer that renewable energy, that's very cheaply produced energy, the closer that is to where you live, the cost goes even further down. You know, when we generate electricity, miles and miles away, and then we have to send it amongst transmission lines and the distribution lines, a lot of that energy gets lost, and the customers are paying for that cost. So having clean energy produced close to your community brings down both the cost of the supply and the delivery costs. And delivery costs are one of the main drivers of why our energy bills have gone up so much. And so having that clean energy generation with close proximity of your community can really help bring down energy bills.
Part of the pushback of that proposed town line solar project in Sullivan County has to do with concerns about land use, conservation, and the character of the rural community. How do you balance those concerns about the need for more renewable energy?
Well, what's really great about New York is that there is a siting process, and the local communities are very engaged in that process. There's studies done that look into all of those factors. What are the environmental impacts? What are there's a whole list of required statutory analysis that goes into where we put these. And a lot of that has local feedback, and communities are able to talk about what are the pros and what are the cons and make a decision on that siting.
Texas is often viewed as an unlikely example when it comes to renewable energy, but wind and solar now provide a substantial share of its electricity. What lessons do you think New York could take from what's happening in Texas and other states? And where do you think the state needs to make its biggest investments?
I think what we're seeing in Texas and other places is that having these sources of renewable energy really brings down the cost of energy. And it's very affordable to generate. You don't have to go buy something to combust in order to generate that energy. And so New York really is very dependent on fossil fuel combustion to power its energy system. But with the climate law and with the goals of cleaning up that energy grid and a transition that is thoughtful and making sure that we have enough supply as we transition away, it will provide us with much more.
Are there specific policy changes Building Decarbonization Coalition wants to see from the governor and state legislature?
Well, I think Dana Levenberg has a bill with Senator Arkham that would incentivize and authorize NYSERDA to have a program that would be targeted specifically for homes on delivered fuels so that they can transition, because delivered fuels in the winter is going to be very expensive. We're seeing delivered fuels like fuel oil, propane, really high levels. And so we want to encourage them to sort of move forward with targeting those households, really help them to move away from those really expensive and dirty sources of energy. So we're really excited about that bill. And then I think we're also encouraged about more investment in the Empower Plus program that will provide people with additional incentives generally so that they can make the transition to more energy efficient as well.
And let's just remind folks again who are listening, who are hearing this, saying, you know, I want to take advantage of lowering energy costs, especially given what I'm seeing in my bills. Where do you think they should start? Where's the first place they should go?
Well, I think if you do an online search and you look for Regional Clean Energy Hub, we have 12 of these clean energy hubs across the state. You can talk with a representative there, and they'll be able to take your information and provide you with, based on your circumstances, the building you live in, you will qualify for all of these incentives. And they have a network of specialized contractors and energy auditors that will come. They'll look at your house. They'll say, oh, you need insulation. Oh, you need to replace that appliance. And then they'll help you to fill out your application in order to be able to then qualify for these great incentives and get those appliances and get that insulation installed in your home. So you go to the Clean Energy Hub, or you can go directly to My Energy Portal that is hosted by NYSERDA, which is the state's energy office.
finally, if we look ahead 10 to 20 years, what do you think a truly climate resilient New York energy system looks like? What needs to happen now to get us there?
Well, certainly we need to continue to move forward with putting on renewable energy, wind, hydro, solar. Those are all really great sources of clean energy, distributed energy. I think one thing that passed in both houses this session was the SUNNY Act, which authorizes balcony solar. So you don't have to have solar panels installed on your roof. You can just plug it right into your wall and it will feed into your energy system and reduce your energy bills. So we're hopeful that Governor Hochul will sign off on that. I think as we bring more of the clean energy online and we transition away from energy sources that are not clean, then that will clean up our energy grid. And then we can provide people with energy efficient homes, energy efficient appliances, and that will be the future that we see, where the grid is clean, healthy, and energy efficient, and homes have smart appliances that communicate with the grid. The technology is really exciting, and I think New York's grid is really old and needs to be replaced. So replacing it with these great new systems will be really great for the future.
That's Michael Hernandez of the Building Decarbonization Coalition. More information at buildingdecarb.org. Michael, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for those tips for homeowners.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, a hidden camera, a county investigation, and a dispute over employee surveillance. We'll have the latest on the story from Ulster County when we come back. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor, offering exhibitions, performances, screenings, and more, with long-term installations from James Turrell and Saul LeWitt. Open year-round. CatskillArtSpace.org.
News comes fast, and it doesn't take weekends off. But we can slow it down a little, take a moment to think, look behind the headlines, and even have some time left over for surprises and a little fun. Join us on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sunday mornings at 8 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A camera owned by Ulster County Controller March Gallagher was found Tuesday hidden in bushes outside the front entrance of the county's Transit Administration building, apparently recording without the knowledge and consent of employees, according to County Executive Jen Metzger. Jason Dole spoke with Times Union reporter Maria Silva for more details about this story.
Yeah, well, turns out that the camera belonged to one person or one office. It was the Ulster County Comptroller March Gallagher. This was part of an investigation into allegations that UCAP managers were falsifying time records and, you know, they're putting the camera, you know, the Ulster County Comptroller explained that putting that camera there was, you know, within her authority, but the Ulster County leadership doesn't think so. So there's been this clash between the comptroller and the Ulster County executive's office.
It definitely sounds like County Executive Jen Metzger is not happy about this. But before we get to what she's saying, though, was there a period of time where you knew that this camera had been found, but you did not know who it belonged to?
Well, not sure about that. We received a statement from Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger's office saying that a camera was found hidden in the bushes and that it was confirmed that it was the property of March Gallagher. And further investigation, I spoke with the Ulster County spokesperson, Amberly Campbell, who explained how it was found. And apparently this was found because several county public works employees were just happened to be mowing the lawn this past Tuesday, and suddenly they hit a device and, you know, found the camera hidden in the bushes. And the reason they knew it was the property of the comptroller was because it had written on it. It had property of March Gallagher written in on the back of the camera. And it also had Gallagher's personal cell phone number written on it. So right after that, the, you know, staff that found the camera handed it over to the Ulster County Sheriff's Office, and they put it into evidence. And, you know, they're, you know, the comptroller's office, you know, was able to retrieve it afterwards. But yeah, this has caused some tension, you know, between the two offices. You know, the Ulster County Executive's office, you know, believes that if there are credible allegations that this should be handled through the proper channels, you know, they have the Department of Personnel, and they think that, you know, secretly surveilling employees is just not standard procedure when you have these types of allegations.
Yeah, you say in a release that County Executive Jen Metzger put out today, she said, quote, no county officials were informed by the comptroller about this surveillance prior to the discovery of the camera, end quote from Jen Metzger. What else is Metzger saying?
Yeah, so Metzger put out a statement, and she essentially says that employees have a right to do their jobs without, you know, being secretly recorded, and that any surveillance conducted without their knowledge or consent is, quote, unacceptable. This is Jen Metzger's statement, and she further stated that the county comptroller had been informed of the county executive's office concerns, as well as the sheriff's office, the Department of Personnel, the county attorney, who is now reviewing the matter, and, as well as the CSEA union leadership. So this is now under review, like I said, by the county attorney's office. And the county attorney's office has actually requested to review the footage, but has not received it or has not been able to review it yet. That was one of the big questions, right? Like, what was the comptroller's office trying to document, and how long had it been there? And also, you know, essentially what was the purpose, right, of leaving a camera there, and why did they not notify county employees of this? And I asked March Gallagher's office these questions, and the response was that they couldn't comment any further, and they just cited the ongoing investigation.
You did get some word from March Gallagher, though. We've gotten response from the Ulster County Comptroller, who seems to be viewing the situation differently, correct?
Yes, yeah, definitely. The County Comptroller's office, you know, they believe that this is within their authority, right, to conduct investigations and audits. And they actually stated that the county building, the UCAT building, has 10 cameras already, which, you know, the county executive office later responded to that statement and said that actually those 10 cameras are just for general security purposes. They're not meant for to, you know, record employees or surveil employees. You know, they're completely different types of cameras, or, you know, the purpose of those cameras is completely different. But yeah, the comptroller's office, you know, their position is that this was part of an investigation and that it was within their authority.
It also raises the question. It's interesting that Comptroller Gallagher, like, put out that statement saying, well, you know, there's already 10 security cameras recording the place 24/7. For a member of the general public like me, that just kind of opens up the next logical question of, like, well, okay, well, then if you're investigating, why didn't you access that already? Like, why'd you go through the channels? You know, if there's already surveillance cameras there, security cameras there, it seems like there could have been a way to work behind the scenes to access that.
Right. But, you know, this was placed in a very specific spot, right? Like, this was found hidden in some bushes pointing towards the front entrance of the UCAT building. So, I mean, I don't want to assume, and, you know, we can't assume, right? But,
yeah,
you know, this this was a camera and it was found there. And, you know, there must have been a purpose, right? People don't do things, you know, with no reason behind it, right? So, like I said, I tried to ask, but I did not get a response. The comptroller's office just cited an investigation and said they couldn't comment on this.
And, you know, County Executive Jen Metzger has made it very clear that she's not happy about this. Her office isn't happy about this. But it also sounds like Ulster Comptroller Marge Gallagher is not happy. Maybe not so much that the camera was found, because it did have her name and phone number right on it. But in that statement, to me, it seems like she's indicating that she'd prefer it if folks like you and I in the public hadn't actually found out about this, because part of the statement says, quote, "It's unfortunate that this ongoing investigation has now been disclosed publicly," end quote. And as you said, it was the executive office that made this information public, correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it could be that the position is that they're worried that now by publicizing this, you know, the investigation would be compromised, which, you know, I would totally understand. But, you know, this is what was found. The Ulster County Executive's Office found it appropriate to publicize and inform the public about this. So we'll see what happens. We'll stay on top of this.
These are very different responses and approaches from County Executive Metzger and Comptroller Gallagher. Does this story highlight any larger rift between them? It seems like they're really in conflict over this.
Yes, this is definitely not their first clash. Actually, 3 years ago, Marge Gallagher's office sued Jen Metzger's office for access to records that the comptroller's office wanted for an investigation into the former finance commissioner, Bert Gulnick, who was who pleaded guilty to embezzling funds. After that lawsuit was filed, you know, Metzger called the comptroller's request an overreach. But later on, a state Supreme Court justice ruled that the records actually fell within the comptroller's authority and ordered the executive's office to hand those records over.
Right. They hadn't handed those records over until there was that determination. So this is very interesting. And my guess is we haven't heard the last about this story, but I'm glad that you were here to bring us the first of it, because now we know what to watch in Ulster County, at least when it comes to the comptroller's hidden camera. And I've been talking to Times Union reporter Maria Silva. Maria, thank you again.
Thank you so much. I look forward to being back on the show again.
And still to come, when tenant farmers in the 19th century pushed back against the land system they believe was keeping them trapped in debt, they launched what became known as the anti-rent wars in New York. We'll hear how that history is portrayed in the film Calico Indians. That's ahead. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, historian Kai Bird. He interviewed Donald Trump several times for his new biography of Roy Cohn.
He interrupts me and he says, "Maybe I can promote it." He says, "Anything I promote goes to number one."
Oh, my God.
And then there's a pause and he says, "Well, of course, it'd have to be fair."
What Roy Cohn taught Trump. Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
This week on Cat's Cast, a continuation of last week's conversation with Judy Van Putt and Nick Lyons, wading even deeper into the life and legacy of Ed Van Putt, Catskills angler, author, and presidential river guide.
He was told that the president wants to fish before dinner. He came in his waders, took his waders off, and immediately started shaking hands.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Chatskill. This weekend in Middletown in Delaware County, there's a screening of Calico Indians. It's a film about the anti-rent strikes of the 19th century and the struggle between tenant farmers and landowners in New York. The Historical Society for the Town of Middletown is hosting the screening Sunday afternoon at the Middletown History Center. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi has more.
Good morning. This is Valerie Manzi. And today we welcome back Diane Galusha of the Historical Society of the Town of Middletown. And she is here to tell us about an event coming up on Sunday the 30th at 2 p.m. The name of the film is Calico Rebellion, and it has something to do with those anti-rent wars we all learned about in school. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you so much.
So tell us about this film.
Sure. This film is, as you said, about the anti-rent wars of the 1830s and 40s. Interesting that you should say that we all learned about it in school, because I never learned about it in school, and I think that is a real shortcoming. There's not a lot of local history in local schools, maybe specific schools, yes, but most schools, maybe not so much.
That's interesting. I mean, I went to school in Brooklyn, New York, and I learned about the anti-rent wars.
You did. That's so interesting. I'm glad to know that.
Well, this was back in the 50s, and we really learned a lot about history and government.
Perhaps you learned about the anti-rent war because it had kind of wide-reaching implications. I'm disappointed to know that it's not taught more widely here in the area where it actually transpired. But the anti-rent war, for those who don't know, was a rebellion by local farmers, Catskill area and eastern New York farmers, who were tenant farmers on lands owned by large patent holders, wealthy, large landholders. And they rented parcels of land to farmers who couldn't afford to buy land, but they could only rent them or lease these parcels, and develop them as farms, clear the land, plant them, you know, build the barn and the house and acquire the livestock and stuff. And then they would, once they were settled, they were required to pay rent of either bushels of wheat or days of labor or work with a wagon or cash per every year to these large landholders. And these were kind of onerous leases for three lives, generally. The original lease lessor, renter, and two people to follow that person, whether it be a son and a grandson or other relatives. So these farmers felt trapped by these leases, and they realized they could never own these properties, and so they revolted against this feudal system. So they donned calico outfits, you know, just basically a gown over their clothes, and scary leather masks, and went about interrupting sales of livestock and farm equipment and such by the county sheriffs. When they fell behind in the rent, the sheriff would be called upon to go around and collect the rent in whatever way possible. So there was a lot of tension, several conflicts, and the episode ended in 1845. When an undersheriff named Osmond Steele was killed in the town of Andes trying to oversee an auction of livestock. And so there had been a crowd of farmers who had surrounded them, and there were several shots fired, and nobody ever really knew who killed him. Many, many people were rounded up and jailed, and many people were sentenced to life imprisonment and even death, but those sentences were ultimately commuted by the governor. So it was a tumultuous time in our history.
So that brings us to the film. Can you tell us a little bit about the film and its creators and its origin story?
The filmmaker is Victoria Kupchinetsky, and she is an award-winning TV journalist and filmmaker. She's a native of Russia, but has been in this country for 46 years, and she's done a number of interesting documentaries, including about women and girls on the Pine Ridge Native American Reservation, and called Lakota Daughters, and other films. Producer, one of the producers is Misha Gutkin, and he is also a Russian emigre, and also a journalist and producer, who has done a lot with major international and national news events, cinematographer, other producers, editor, animator. They've done a wonderful job on this film, which is 70 minutes long. It kind of came about because when Victoria, what happened to be in Andes, came to Andes where there was a community celebration and parade featuring people who wore the costumes, and it was basically honoring this episode that concluded in Andes. It was so pivotal to Andes history. And she was really taken by this, and she wanted to kind of explore this idea of Americanness, you know, the struggles and sacrifices and violence even that laid the foundation for the American dream.
And there was violence.
Oh, yes. I mean, not only, it wasn't just the murder of Osmond Steele, but mm-hmm. there were episodes, there was conflicts, you know, all over the place. There was something called the Battle of Shacksville in Roxbury, where uprenters, people who believed in the rule of law, and this was a legal system, this landholding system, combated the rebellious farmers who didn't see it that way. They saw themselves as the sons of the American Revolution, and that this was not freedom as they were taught to believe in it. Yeah, there were many conflicts. County sheriff's agents were tarred and feathered, and there were many, many other instances where, you know, people were pitted against each other. It was a really fraught time in our history, and worthy of recognition. I'm really surprised that it took this long for someone to produce a documentary about this, because it is so full of drama and color and an interesting history that reverberated throughout New York State.
And not so different from what we're facing today, as history repeats itself.
Well, yes. I mean, because there is such freedom of speech, there have always been people on both sides of whatever issue is being contested.
Well, democracy is messy.
Yes.
One other question I have. They call themselves Calico Indians, and I wondered how the indigenous community would respond to that today. And another thing in my research, and I don't know that it's correct, it said that a number of the Calicos were teenage boys.
Well, I don't know how many were teenage boys.
Okay.
But, you know, it was mostly a male occupation
okay.
in terms of the actual donning of costumes and participating in these protests and gathering in meetings and, you know, recruiting new members. But women were very actively involved in making these costumes and secreting them, you know, the people who were being sought by the posses. But as far as the Indians are concerned, the Calico Indians patterned themselves, I'm told, after the so-called, quote, Indians who attacked the ships in the British ships in Boston Harbor and tossed the tea overboard. They were also considered and disguised as so-called Indians. I don't know how current, you know, modern-day indigenous people would perceive that.
Okay, so is there anything else you'd like to add before we conclude, Diane?
Well, I would just like to tell people that it's at the Middletown History Center at 778 Cemetery Road in Margaretville. You can also go to calicorebellion.com to see a trailer of this film. It is 70 minutes long, and admission is by donation. We hope to see folks there and explore this topic with four people who are heirs to this rebellion, who are descendants of some of the people who participated in it. So four people will be there to have a kind of a Q&A with the audience afterwards. So we hope folks will show up for that.
Well, thank you for taking your time to share this with our listeners and for embarking on this project to share with your community.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi for that. Coming up after the break, David Driver on his remarkable career from the original Broadway cast of Rent to collaborations with Laurie Anderson, Lou Reed, and Elvis Costello, and his upcoming performance at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse this weekend. Stay with us. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Science Friday, your doctor is probably using AI. We'll talk about how it's changing healthcare, plus social media's favorite nerve.
What happens in the vagus nerve does not stay in the vagus nerve. It controls your heart rate, your lungs, your diaphragm, your breathing rate.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today, 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Early radio enthusiasts discovered something about shortwave broadcasting.
Radio waves are sent out in all directions.
That was different from AM and FM.
When these waves strike the antenna of a receiving set, we hear sound originating at that very moment, hundreds or even thousands of miles away.
Long live the shortwaves on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. David Driver has built a career spanning Broadway, jazz, alternative pop, and standards, performing and working with artists including Laurie Anderson, Lou Reed, Elvis Costello, Debbie Harry, and they might be giants among some of them. He was part of the original Broadway cast of Rent and has also developed his own multimedia performances combining music, storytelling, and history. Driver will perform Sunday at 4 at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse, and he's joining us now with a preview. David Driver, welcome.
Thank you, Tim.
Let's start with that August 30th performance coming up at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse. We mentioned a lot of the big names and big places you've played, from Broadway to off-Broadway theaters to much smaller, intimate spaces like Rock Valley. What do you enjoy about performing in a space like the Rock Valley Schoolhouse?
Well, first of all, Tim, you made me sound really fancy, and I appreciate that.
But you are.
That intro, I was like, wow. I've never performed at Rock Valley Schoolhouse before. I've been to a lot of shows there. I think people probably know that it's a series that's been going on for a few years now. And it's a really cool space. It's an actual old schoolhouse that is sort of done up with the original things that would have been in an old schoolhouse. It's also acoustically a really interesting space because it's, I guess the term would be live. It's a live kind of space. So a lot of people perform with no amplification whatsoever when they do stuff there. I'm going to be a little bit experimental with the format, and I'm going to use a little bit of amplification, but a little bit of unamplification. Which I'm looking forward to because I think it's a very flexible space. To answer your question, I don't know what playing that room is like, but everyone, I saw Laura Cantrell there last weekend, who is someone I've really admired for a long time.
Spoke with her about that, and she was talking about how just an intimate venue like that just brings a different sense of performance to the artist, and I talked about all the different folks you've worked with in different genres, a lot of musical territory you've covered. How do you describe your musical identity today?
My musical identity. I saw Roseanne Cash once do a performance, and she said, she pointed out to the audience that music is a service industry, which I hadn't thought of before, but it is. It is a service industry. So I think the term I use is creative services. I mean, creative services and music is one part of that. Music for me fulfills a very clear and specific function. Recorded music, live music in its own way. And I'm part of my life journey is to figure out exactly what that is. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I've been lucky in that I've been able to move through a number of different musical worlds and spheres. I love doing that. I wouldn't want to do just one thing, you know.
One of the things I wanted to point out was the music and storytelling that you combine with some history as well. Your Stonewall project, there's a riot going on, for example, used popular music of the time to tell that story of the 1969 uprising. What do you think about combining that history element in music can do to help with an account that maybe a traditional narrative can't provide?
Like in that show, there's a riot going on. Wow, that's a, I don't know if I know how to answer that question. With that particular show, a lot of the material, which actually was on the jukebox at the Stonewall Inn when those very, very culturally significant riots happened, a lot of the music in a weird way kind of informed that moment, you know, and informed what happened in that place. I guess I'll answer your question by saying I think that when music connects, it's such a personal thing. It's almost a chemical thing. But when it connects, I think it just magnifies the strength of any feeling or any information that's coming in for me. So to combine sort of documentary, factual information in a show like that with the deep, intense emotion and sort of pathos of music, I think it sort of all redoubles on itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And when you approach a project like that one, for example, is the, does it start with sort of an idea? Like, was the idea like, oh, there were these songs on the jukebox, and then you develop the idea of the show after, off that? Or where does that creative process sort of begin for you?
That particular one started because in 2019, a group of venues and performance organizations in New York City wanted to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. Symphony Space, which is a really great venue, reached out to me about doing something, and that was where the original impetus of it was. It was like, oh, let's do music that was actually on that jukebox, because there's a lot of mythology around Stonewall, mm-hmm. but those are, that's something that we know factually. We know what was on the jukebox. So
can I ask you about something that may be a clearer inspiration for you?
Yes.
Standards and Classics and Starsky, No Hutch,
uh-huh.
which was connecting your teenage fascination with the television character Starsky?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I think fascination might be an understatement. yeah, I grew up in a really different era when there was not representation of queer people very much in media. There was like Paul Lynde. There was Charles Nelson Reilly.
Always exaggerated.
Yeah. You know, there was, you know, the maid from the Brady Bunch, pretty obviously, you know, there was stuff like that. So for me as a kid, and when I was first sort of coming into myself as an adult, I was really looking for affirmation of who I am and who I might be. And I found it in the television show Starsky and Hutch, because to be clear, I own the entire series on DVD, the entire thing. And I can pretty much tell you, you know, a lot about it. But if you go back and watch it, they are essentially having, people might call it a bromance. I'd say it comes right up to the edge of the of a romance. And it was very inspiring to me to see these two, you know, manly, smart, you know, active men who were essentially continually expressing their love for each other and getting thrown into each other's arms and ending up shirtless in a steam room with their guns on. It was a big thing for me. So that show was about, you know, my strong feeling about that character, my strong love for the character, as well as what happened. The actor who portrayed that character, Paul Michael Glaser, experienced some profound trauma related to AIDS when he was his wife died. Mm-hmm. So, and that was a very, very challenging thing for me to witness as a young gay man. So, mm-hmm. you know.
We talked a little off air about some of the projects you're working on. We talked about on air about all the different experiences you've had and projects you've worked on. What's continuing to excite you about performing?
Wow. Well, you know, it comes and goes. I think that I think there are some people who have a much easier time putting themselves and their vision out into the world in a sort of unqualified way. I find it hard sometimes. But I guess that's what makes it also exciting to me, you know, like any kind of, you know, I think when I watch a performer that the performers that I like the most have a kind of vulnerability and express an authenticity about themselves. That's what moves me. Doing that is harder than taking it in. Watching it is easier than doing it. But I guess in terms of what excites me, I don't know. For me, it's a real privilege to be able to do work and put something into the world that might shift people's perspective, that might inspire people in some way, that might move people in some way, or or let them think or feel differently, that's a privilege. So, yeah.
Let's listen a little to some of your work here so folks can get a taste of what to expect perhaps on August 30th at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse.
Two days from now, yeah.
2 days from now, maybe. Yeah, yeah. You're not sure, but maybe it will be this. This is Dreams Brew of Faraway Roses from David Driver.
Sunday morning cartoon. Drift away and I found you. I was so high, I know. Dreams brew far away.
Driver, Dreams Brew of Faraway Roses. What can you tell us about this track, David?
Wow, we went out right at the part where it starts to get big. That is a track that was written by Adam Bernstein, a very, very valuable and valued collaborator, from an album called Driver Quartet Nighttime that was released, I don't know, some number of years ago. My friend and colleague Peter Kiesewalter also worked on that album, and he will be playing with me on Sunday, as well as a woman named Whitney LaGrange, an incredible, incredible violin player, so skilled, and Jeremy Chatsky, who I think audiences may be familiar with because mm-hmm. he worked with Laura Cantrell. He's done a number of different things. So it'll be intimate, but, you know, but not too intimate.
There's a tease. Where can folks find out more about your projects and your music?
For the show that I'm developing, there's a riot going on, which is about Stonewall, which is a continuing thing. The website is theirs-a-riot.com. And that gives a lot of information about sort of what the show has been and what it's going to turn into. And on social media, I'm just on Instagram. I am terrified of TikTok. If you know a TikTok manager that you can hook me up with, I'm not on TikTok, but on Instagram, it's David Von Driver, DavidVonDriver.
And David Driver performing at Rock Valley Schoolhouse on Sunday at 4. More information about that on Instagram at Rock Valley Schoolhouse. David Driver, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
See if we can get the big part again.
Oh, yeah, good, good.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
Today's forecast, some clouds giving way to sunshine this afternoon, a high of 77. Clear, cooler tonight, low 49. Tomorrow and Sunday, a really pleasant weekend. Sunny, nice, less humid, a high of 76 on Saturday, 79 on Sunday with some clouds moving in and humidity back into the forecast on Monday. On Point is coming up next. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill.